Welcome back to Dating Games, the Modern Relationships Podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Temps, and our guest this week is a multi-award-winning podcaster and activist as host of the Masala Podcast, a show which challenges shame by delving openly into taboo topics within South Asian culture. I'm delighted to welcome Sangeeta Pillai.
Such a joy to be here, Bobby. Thank you so much for asking me. This is probably my second Irish podcast. I feel really kind of new and excited about it. I'm just like,
that's
people in Ireland are going to hear my voice.
Yeah, and it's really booming over here, which is lovely to see. And like globally as well, like some of the podcasts here, because of the size of our population, are way more famous internationally, have more international listeners than here, which is, yeah, which is kind of cool.
Which is cool because you're like, okay, I'll take all the listeners.
If anything, you maybe get a bit of the opposite way around where you've created a podcast out of your own experience. First growing up in India and then living in the UK. And so it was founded between you and an American podcast conglomerate and then has had such a global listenership because whilst it's something specific to maybe the British Asian experience in some ways, it also connects so much to where you're from and shame and taboos around topics like sex that really everyone can relate to.
Yeah. And funny you should say that. It's incredible to me. So I was invited to run some workshops and record an episode at the University of Berkeley, California. And what was astonishing is how many of the things we discussed are exactly the things we discuss in the UK.
Yeah.
And in India. So it doesn't almost matter. The South Asian experience is very, very similar. Whether you grew up in India, whether you grew up in the UK, whether you grew up in the US, whether you grew up in Ireland, it's pretty similar. If you're kind of a female identifying South Asian person, chances are 9 out of 10 of those things will be common to all of you. And I guess the broader conversation also is that shame translates. I think what you and I were speaking about before we kind of hit record, these are universal themes, aren't they?
For sure. And I agree. I certainly grew up seeing a lot of those parallels. A lot of it does trace back to like the British Empire and anywhere that it touched, there were similar stories. By contrast, we see so much progress and so much that has changed in our respective countries these days where you can look back. I've heard you talk about on your show before, you can look back 1 or 2 generations and see how much things have changed. And so you can have a very common perspective on certain topics for our generation. But then you look back to our parents or our grandparents, and we're talking about things that they would never dare discuss.
Exactly. Exactly. Isn't it astonishing how much we've grown in what, 30 years, 20, 30 years? It's dramatic, I think, the growth. And do you find that within your culture as well?
Definitely. Definitely. And we've, you know, had such kind of turning points as well in relatively recent history, like marriage equality being voted for. And even at the time, you know, I didn't think that vote would go the way it did. I wasn't sure that Ireland had changed as much as clearly it has. And that's even with being so on the pulse with it, we can be surprised by the speed of progress. And before we get into anything else, would you mind sharing a dating story you had in mind?
Yes, this goes probably goes back, she's 6, 7 years. And I was trying a lot of online dating. I'd come out of a very long relationship, like a 10-year relationship. And as you do, you dive into every dating app you can find, right? Like you're like, oh my God, I'm swiping. So I was having one of those times. I was just about to turn 40, I think. So anyway, I went on a couple of dates and, you know, I had a great time. And I was kind of loving meeting a lot of people from different backgrounds who I wouldn't normally have met. And this one particular date, I think I met this chap over the evening somewhere in central London. He seemed really nice. We kind of, I think we met for coffee and then said, should we carry on having a drink? Because he seemed really nice. Sat down, ordered our drinks. And then he turns to me. He kind of comes a bit closer to me, like his, and I was like, oh, I wonder what he's going to say. And I thought, oh, this might be a little bit, I don't know, interesting, sexual. Who knows, right? He lowers his voice and he says, you know, I've been meaning to ask you this all evening. What? Do you do the Kama Sutra? And I was like, whoa. And I put my drink down and I said, I have a couple of things to say to you. Hey, nobody can do the Kama Sutra. It's an ancient book from the 4th century. It's got like, I don't know, 9 chapters and thousands of words. You can't do a thing. which of those things can you do? Like, and I gave him this massive lecture and says it's a way of life, and it's like the cosmopolitan kind of person's skill set includes, you know, playing the violin and being really good at sex. So you can't just do it. And I said, and don't you think that's really, really racist? Just because I'm Asian, you're asking me to do the Kama Sutra. Yeah, I'd give him a massive dressing down. So that was my memorable date.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming the man in the story was white. Is that correct?
Yes. He was white. He was middle class. He was English.
Yeah. And had clearly, you know, read all of one book.
Yeah. Had read the title, the cover. He yeah. hadn't even read one book.
Oh, dear. It's sadly such a common experience. And it's, you know, fair play to you in that moment for so articulately pushing back on it. Because, of course, in that moment, it can be difficult to not give in to even the shame there of this person has completely misunderstood my culture, has boiled it into one thing that they've then fetishized. And in this moment, it can feel quite weaponized, even if that wasn't the intention. It takes you aback so much. There can be that instinct to shrink, to want to apologize, to want to placate the shame that you might be feeling and, you know, escape.
Absolutely. And I think it's such an internalized thing, this cultural shame that we carry when we live in other countries that aren't kind of where we're born, maybe, or where our cultural origin is. And I think a lot of the time we are kind of defending ourselves, defending our culture, defending our right to be in that place. And obviously the dating story was a funny one. It made me really angry. So therefore I was articulate. So I think anger sometimes gives you the words. Like, how dare you say that? You know, but sometimes, you know, there are no words. Like, I was at this co-working space a couple of weeks ago and I've taken my lunch and this guy pops up and says, it's curry, isn't it? And I'm like, excuse me? He said, yeah, your lunch smells like curry. And the way he said it was very derogatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel it in my body. And I was like, so am I supposed to feel shame about this food that, I don't know, 90% of the UK loves to eat and pays for? And this is from my culture. And I was like, I said, yeah, it is. I said, and actually, there's no such thing as curry. It's like, it's a whole, you know, you've taken, again, a whole cuisine or an identity and boiled it down to one word. So, you know, it's something we constantly, I think, as people living in other cultures, are constantly juggling and battling and trying to find our place and still claim our culture and still be proud of it, while a lot of the world is trying to tell us that we cannot be proud of it.
Yeah. And you have that complex power imbalance that so many people aren't aware of. You know, if you're living in a place where you are not part of the majority culture, you have to, as part of the assimilation, learn so much about their culture in a way that doesn't necessitate reciprocation. And so if he generalizes your cuisine, then that's seen as forgivable. Why should he know better? But if you called a bagel a sandwich, you might equally you're the villain in both situations.
Absolutely. I mean, a massive point of fact is how you pronounce, I don't know, Worcestershire or Derbyshire, or none of them are written the way they are pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And when you first move to the UK, you're constantly corrected. And it's very important that you kind of understand how to say Worcestershire instead of saying Worcestershire, which is how you, you know, if you were reading phonetically, you know, that's how you'd say it. But then no one will try and understand or learn how to pronounce your name. I mean, I've been in workplaces where people have called me Sanjita for years and years, despite me correcting them. But again, that imbalance, right?
Yeah.
That you just spoke of.
It's not a difficult name, but it's, you know, it's an awareness. It's a level of effort that needs to be applied. We have the same with so many common Irish names, like Niamh is one of the most common. It doesn't read like it writes if you're English, but within the context of our language, it makes sense. But I've had times when it's been treated as Irish people being obtuse for how we spell our names.
Or being difficult or complicated.
Yeah. Like, why would it not be anglicized? And the answer is, you're not in charge of our country anymore. We're no longer part of the empire. That's why. You know,
it's a minor matter.
Yeah. And actually, so much of it is anglicized. So much of our language was lost. So many of the places that we call home within this country have the names that suited the people in power at the time versus our language and our culture. And it is difficult when you see these imbalances and you're clued into them. You're clued into the microaggressions that can occur and the people around you are oblivious.
So much of that weight, I think, is something we carry, and it adds to, I don't know, this weight of constantly portraying your culture in a positive light, but at the same time, being able to challenge certain aspects of your culture that you might not agree with. Like, as you know, with my work, there's a lot of things that I challenge within my own culture, but it's such a balance, and it's a difficult balance at times, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. And I know that that's a big conversation in dating these days, is there are a lot of people that are thinking, actually, what is the balance in terms of who I date? That in some ways, if you're living in this increasingly multicultural world, there can be such freedom in the options and the ways that we can date and get to understand each other's culture better via that exploration. And in turn, understand, you know, ourselves and the kind of shared human connections. And yet, there are all these elements that can also make that exhausting.
Yeah.
That you're like, okay, on one hand, I'm trying to shake off stuff that maybe there'd be certain expectations of who I should or shouldn't date. But then on the other hand, you've got, okay, but then if I go too far outside of my culture, then there's all this additional baggage. Then can I count on being understood in my most intimate relationship?
Yeah, that's a really tricky balance, actually. And a lot of the women that I work with will talk about this a lot, about who do you choose to be with? If you're really attached to your culture, you might try and find an Asian partner, a South Asian partner, or whatever. You know. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of patriarchal attitudes still within South Asian culture. And sometimes the partner from another culture might be able to actually understand that better. Mm-hmm. But it's a constant juggle, you know, where you're giving a part of yourself up, you know? Sacrificing one thing for the other when you're dating someone, I think.
You know, I sometimes, in my more cynical moments, I wonder, how can we ensure healthy relationships? Because it can feel like every relationship we come out of, over time, we look back and we see all the things that, you know, whilst initially there's that loss, as we grieve the relationship, all these things come up of, oh, well, I don't miss that part. And I don't think I'll date somebody that has that trait again. And this bit was kind of toxic. You can find yourself wondering, are there any healthy relationships? And I think, you know, that the more positive side of me then says, well, a lot of it is down to compromise. There are relationships that can bring so much to our life and be healthy in so many ways. There are also always compromises within that. And so when we look back on a relationship we're no longer in, particularly when we're glad we're no longer in it, we can, of course, focus on, okay, these are the things that I don't miss. And where is that line between compromising for the good of the unit and in a way that you're both happy with versus compromising potentially on who you are, on things that were important to you as a single person?
Yeah, true. And while you were speaking, I was starting to think that, yes, that's one aspect of it. Like, how much are you prepared to compromise on your needs for the sake of being in this unit? And there's so much pressure, I think, in society to be coupled up, you know, particularly Western society. And this is one place where I think in many ways, South Asian culture, there's a lot of, you have to get married. You know, like someone like me is like, oh my God, I've been told to get married since I was about 18, right? It's kind of part of the deal. But having said that, there is an acceptance of individuals within the culture as well. You don't necessarily have to only be coupled up, right? Whereas in Western culture, I feel like the emphasis is very much on the couple or the family unit, really, rather than a communal or a community as a concept. And the other thing that struck me when you were speaking was, like, one is what you said there, which is deciding or allowing yourself to compromise in as much as you want to fit in. So how much of you do you want it in? How much of this unit do you want to be in? Personally, for me, I've looked back on relationships and seen my own growth in every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dramatic. So I think relationships can be ground for massive growth, massive upheaval, and massive growth. And somehow it's only when you come out of it, it's almost like a marker of the, you know, when you look at, like, oh, 10 years ago, I was doing this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I've come so far. And it's the same thing with relationships. I'm like, with X person, oh my God, that's what I was talking about. That's what I was doing. I'm not even the same person anymore. Say 6, 8 years down the line, I look back at relationships and I think, oh my God, what's that person? I'm unrecognizable. That's how much I've changed.
Yes. And, you know, there is a good bit of awareness to cling to there where you can look back and think about all these horrible exes, but also we were very different people.
We were very different.
You know, would you want to date the you you were 10 years ago? Probably not.
Probably not.
You know, so I think there's always room to acknowledge, okay, there were ways in which we were the problem as well. And, you know, that's so interesting what you said about like the cultural differences there, because I think there is such kind of subtle nuance to that, where there's such a focus on family across so many cultures, and yet in a lot of Western society, some of that has changed where it's smaller now. So a lot of that pressure has come into, okay, the unit of who you live with, two parents, however many kids, and you've got to cope with everything yourself. Like that can increasingly be the expectation in a way that some cultures that are more steeped in tradition, there can be elements of that that are challenging. There can be elements of it that are beneficial. You know, I guess, yeah, Ireland is maybe somewhat sat between, you know, the UK and India on that front, where, you know, family is, it can feel like it's prioritized in different ways, which I love, but also that can come with increased family expectations of how much other people get to be involved in your relationship and what they think of it, who they think it should be with.
Yeah. I suppose the beauty of it, like every time I've come to Ireland, I've thought about how warm the people are. There's a real warmth to the people. And it reminds me of India in many ways. You know, you're like on a bus and someone says hello to you and someone comments on your jacket or whatever. And that's, it's a very human connection, I think. It's a good thing, and it's nurturing for us, I think, to have those connections. We were never meant to be individualistic in this society, as we're being told. We just consume and we're individuals and we just look after ourselves. We were never meant to be that. I think like Esther Perel always talks about, like, we were meant to be in a tribe, and the tribe looked after the family, and different members of the tribe met different needs. And now every need is supposed to be met by our significant other, our partner. You're supposed to be their friend, and they're supposed to be your partner and your confidant and your career coach and your holiday buddy. No wonder then relationships are under so much pressure, because no one human being can fulfill all those needs.
Yeah, it's so true. I often joke about it with toasters, that it really serves capitalism for us to all live separately, because then you sell more toasters.
I like that.
And it's such a silly example, but you start looking at the world like that, and you do see those things.
Yeah.
And so many things that would have been lovely, we've been taught to find shame around, like handing down clothes.
Yes.
Or gifting, like crypts and things that we no longer need, as we all go through these collective different life stages. Now it's like, oh no, but your baby should have a new crib. According to who? And would you mind sharing a little bit about what your thoughts around sex in particular were, kind of growing up with influences of family and culture?
Well, my sex education was zero, non-existent. And growing up, the dominant message was that sex was something that men did, and that women we just sort of put up with. And what I was told was, like, when you get married, you have to do this thing, and you're doing it to please the man. That's what he wants. You'll not want this, but, you know, it's your duty as a good, dutiful wife. And I always make this joke. It's like, we're supposed to sort of, on our wedding night, obviously be virgins, sort of lie there and think of India while, you know, the man does whatever he wants to do. So sex was never for women, is what I was taught. We never had any volition. We never had any control. We were just kind of, you know, participants in the act. And there was no sex education, really. And I found out about sex through women's magazines. So I'd read, and I was a very naive kind of teenager. I grew up in India in the 80s. There was like zero exposure. We had like one TV channel, which played for 4 hours every evening. We had like a couple of magazines. So I'd go find these magazines and cut out all the personal, you know, like personal questions, like the Ask Deirdre type questions, except it was probably Ask Ramona or something. And the questions was always about sex. And I'd be like, this is interesting. And I kind of used to cut it all out, keep it in this little folder. And that kind of became my little, almost like puzzles, pieces of puzzle. And at one point, I'm like, oh, that's what happens. So it kind of came together in my head. And I kind of remember looking around, people say, oh my God, these people do that. And I was really horrified. And even in my first kind of relationships in India, I knew nothing about my own body because we were never encouraged to look at our own selves. You know, there's a lot of shame around our bodies as women. We were supposed to hide our bodies from men. We were supposed to kind of cover everything up because you go up, go out and you get groped and they tell you, well, it was your fault. Why were you wearing this or doing that? So we were taught to shrink and be really, really small. And I would imagine very, very few women or girls at that time looked at themselves to see who they were. You're like, what is my body? And so we had zero understanding of how our bodies worked.
I want to pause on that, actually, because that part is so real, that the shame can become so focused in that way that you will avoid even looking at yourself, that you will avert your eyes in a mirror getting changed. And it's terrifying to me because it is so common. And that's how this kind of oppression seeps into our psyches. You know, we can carry that shame, the shame that in some ways may be painted as something to protect women, you know, of I want her to look after herself, to stay safe, you know, in certain ways before she's ready or before marriage, whatever kind of paradigms are used to justify the shame. But it's done in such a way, in such an intensity, that without intervention, you carry that shame for your entire life. And so the very thing that was meant to be productive and helpful towards marriage becomes the very thing that can end so many marriages, that can leave you feeling so unfulfilled.
Absolutely. And in many ways, you're always taught within the culture that just by being a woman, you're provocative. Like you're carrying this provocativeness within you just by existing. And therefore, you've got to kind of dim yourself and shut yourself up because, I mean, oh, God forbid, a man sees that and then he takes what is there. Mm. You know, and that's the kind of attitude that men will take. And you're just, it's just by your very existence, you're somehow causing that, you know? Yeah.
And it's such a strange paradox that women can be so commoditized around sex. And it can be something that is both not talked about in society openly, but something that is so explicitly acknowledged at the same time that you need to cover up because a man might be thinking about sex, but we don't talk about that. We just encourage you in all these ways that are sold as to do with your safety and not his potential villainy.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if a girl was groped or, you know, or something worse, you know, if she was raped or whatever, the emphasis always was on the woman. It was always the woman's fault. She must have done something. Where were you? What were you wearing? And that exists not just in my culture. It exists all over the world, unfortunately, even today. Where were you? What were you doing? You know? And I think that is the real shame, I think.
Yes. It is horrible and it's horrific. And you're so right. It still continues. And in many ways, the pushback, whilst there is a lot of progress, the pushback can also create insidious ways that this stuff continues to kind of burrow down, and it then becomes harder to call out, and we find ourselves having conversations that are then very boiled down. You know, like I've been having a lot more conversations recently relating to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, because whilst it doesn't directly affect where we live, that doesn't mean it won't at some point. That doesn't mean that the re-questioning of something that had been decided as a human right doesn't potentially have impact all over the world. And so often you can find yourself dragged into these watered down, I don't know if people like the use of the term watered down, but I think you'll know what I mean. These kind of like over-reduced conversations of like, okay, well, what if someone's right? And I don't know how you find this, but I find that very offensive in some ways to think, okay, so a woman's right has to rely on her being painted as a victim.
Yes.
You know, as if that extreme has to occur for her right to be valid.
Yes.
And not that we should start from the place of the woman should have autonomy over her own body. And rather than parallel that, let's parallel what it'd be like for the men. We've got to have a medical procedure against our consent. We'd be out on the streets in an instant.
Exactly. Exactly. It's so funny you should say this. Like, I was saying this the other day to a friend. It's like, if there was as much as an inkling of a man's fertility belonging to the state, you'd have riots on the street. People would be killed. But because we've demonized women's bodies and women's sexuality so much, what are we saying with this law? That a woman's body belongs to the state, basically. That we've got no agency. We've got no control over something that is ours. Like, it's in our body. It's not external to us. I mean, how bonkers is that? It makes no sense. In no other context would that be even remotely acceptable. In any other, forget about, you know, we're talking about our sexual reproductive organs. I don't know, tomorrow somebody came along and said, to get a tattoo, you've got to get consent. Can you imagine that? What would happen? And we're not talking about anything life-changing. It's a tattoo. But here you're saying it affects somebody's entire existence, right? It changes their entire life dramatically. And you're taking that right away from them? It's inconceivable to me that this is happening in the world. Yeah. Absolutely inconceivable.
Yeah, well, I mean, pregnancy alone can be almost inconceivable, even if you're going through it, you know, how much it changes your body. You know, your organs have to move around to accommodate the baby. Calcium from your teeth is taken and rediverted. There's so much that goes on a chemical level. It's more complicated to create a baby in a womb than it was when our planet was created. The earth we stand on is less chemically complicated than what's happening inside a pregnant woman's being. Yes. And if we can't even wrap our head around the magnitude of that, how can we ever think we can control it on behalf of other people? It's wild, but it comes back to, again, a lot of what you've described, these normalized ideas, that even if we don't actively think them, they can seep in. Like, you described sex being something you were raised to think of as for the man. You know, and I'd say when it is thought of as for the woman, it's for babies. It's for his pleasure and it's for her babies.
Yeah, absolutely. Even in 2022, unfortunately, that is where the world sits. A lot of the world sits. Coming back to the baby question, you know, we're taught that unless you reproduce as a woman, what is your function in the world? You know, you're constantly asked this. And I am somebody who chose not to have children. And I was constantly asked, like, why? It completely boggled people's minds that it's like, oh, so you can and you're choosing not to. So you're basically denying your entire purpose on this planet. I mean, look at that. So we're boiled down to what, like our ovaries, like our womb. That's all we are as human beings.
And that narrative is so normalized that that seems a perfectly acceptable question to ask, even though there are constantly jokes and conversations had around how that is such an intimate thing to ask about, how that isn't okay to demand answers out of women on what they plan to do with their fertility. And yet, it's still normalized to an extent of, if you said that the other way around, if you turn around to them and say, well, tell me, just before that, tell me this, why did you have children? Then you will not get a friendly reaction to that question. No. And yet it's the same question in reverse. It shouldn't be any more or any less wild a thing.
Exactly. Because again, coming back to what you were saying, we're told that women's bodies exist for men's pleasure and to produce babies. Like, what is our purpose in the world otherwise, you know? Like, that's all we're here for, is what we're taught. Within my culture, definitely, within broader culture, Western culture, East culture, it's pretty similar, I think, the narrative.
For you then, what was the process of unpicking that? And to what extent was moving to the UK part of that?
I think about this a lot. I was born different, I think. I just knew when I was kind of growing up that none of the stuff I was being told rang true for me. I didn't agree with a lot of what was being said about women's roles and what they did and what they didn't do. So I was very, very rebellious, I think, growing up. And I kind of left home and I started reading a lot and things like that. I left home much, much later because in the India of the 80s, you didn't leave home unless you got married. You either died or got married, and that's the two times you left home, you know? So it took me kind of a good 10, 15 years to try and manage and wrangle a job in another city to leave. But I think all along, I probably read a lot and kind of questioned a lot. And it was very difficult for people around me because I was saying things that they couldn't understand and no one else was saying those things at that time. And I was like, why is it this way? Why can't I be this way? Why are you asking me to do this? You know, I don't agree with this. I don't agree with that. So a lot of that kind of challenging happened as I was growing up and as I was going through my life. And what is beautiful about kind of my move to the UK is I was able to see my own culture from the outside, I think. And the beauty of the UK, I mean, we've talked about some of the negatives, but the positives definitely are you can be whoever you want to be here. Nobody stops you. And you can ask difficult questions and you have the right to kind of voice whatever it is you're feeling or thinking. And I think being away and having that kind of freedom and independence gave me the opportunity to really ask difficult questions of my own culture and look at it from the outside in. And that's how the kind of work that I do with Soul Sutras, kind of talking about taboos in our culture, came to be. That's how Masala Podcast came to be. All of it came from a place of like, surely we as women have the opportunity to take the bits of the culture that work for us and challenge the bits that do not work for us anymore. And there was a whole kind of, I started by running workshops where I'd get women to write their stories, which then kind of went into kind of two theater shows, which then got into the podcast. And the kind of feedback I got was phenomenal. And that's what kind of kept me going doing the work. All these women would kind of write to me. They'd find my email address. They'd find my kind of social media and say, oh my God, you know, this happened to me too. And thank you for talking about it. Thank you for challenging. Thank you for being brave and inspiring and things like that. So I think being in the UK, in answer to your question, gave me the space, the freedom, and the opportunities, really, to challenge some of the cultural norms that I'd grown up with. And do it in a way that was empathetic and sympathetic. I'm very, very proudly South Asian. You know, like I wear saris to all my events. I don't know if you saw me at the podcast festival. I was wearing a sari. I always do. And I celebrate Diwali and I wear my bindis. And I, you know, like I love my culture. So it comes from that place of saying, look at this amazing, rich culture we have. We're the people that wrote the Kama Sutra, the original text on sexuality. And, you know, we worship goddesses in our culture, you know? So why can we then not challenge these problematic bits of the culture? Why are we just taking it all, saying, okay, this is my culture? I'm like, we have the opportunities now to challenge some aspects of it and to say, this works for me, this doesn't work for me. And I'm still South Asian. I'm still very proud of this culture. So that's kind of the journey, really.
Yeah. No, that's so fascinating. And I relate to it a lot because many parts of the culture when I was living in the UK were challenging to me. And I similarly had that feeling of needing to represent, that people would ask me questions about Ireland all the time. And a lot of the questions came from a point of very limited context or knowledge. It's the politest way I can say it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you do feel that pressure. And yet in that, there can be an opportunity to kind of re-examine your culture and sort of be like, okay, these are the wonderful things I can tell you about, but we also have these issues too. And having that kind of cultural comparison, I find so helpful. And it's wild when people don't have it. Do you know what I mean? When you're used to it, it's very strange when you see how it is to not have that. You know, even things like in the pandemic, I was constantly reminded of this because of the rhetoric. You know, that people would be hearing Boris Johnson talking about like the world's best rollout of vaccinations. Sections of that were the fastest, but it's not the whole story. A higher proportion of the population here in Ireland are vaccinated compared to the UK. He doesn't mention that bit, you know?
And that's very convenient.
Yeah. And that stuff doesn't hit the news. We don't have these sort of things. And it's, you see it seep down to even a lot of the guests I talk to. It can be very difficult to articulate cultural differences, even when you have experienced them, because we don't have the context and the language. If other people aren't doing it, it's very difficult to be the first.
Absolutely.
And so I appreciate your work for that reason, that you are getting to break down these things that people so relate to from similar backgrounds. But for myself, you know, listening to your show, I find so many parallels. So much of the human experience in it.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's beautiful about it, isn't it? Sort of at the end of the day, every single human being on this planet, what are the things we want? We want love, we want connection, we want kind of obviously food and, you know, all of those basic things. But outside of that, that's what we want. We want to be understood. We want to be loved. That's it, right?
Yeah. And imagine a world where we prioritized those things.
Yes. Wouldn't it be just revolutionary?
Yeah. So we will keep plugging away in our corners to do that. And for now, we do need to start wrapping up. So do you have something in mind, a bit of advice? So a rule of the game that you try and live by with dating or relationships?
So I'd like to say, don't accept someone who doesn't see your truth as you are. Don't settle, because the world is telling us that we need to be with somebody, be coupled up, and somehow you're incomplete. Like, that's the message you're given, that somehow we're always looking for this other person to complete us. No, you are complete. Complete and beautiful and amazing as you are. So only date or agree to date somebody long term if they see all of you and they make you bigger than you are, not smaller.
Oh,
that's my rule.
I love that so much. And I would add, kind of in line with a lot of what we've talked about today, that there's such power in owning the things that you don't know. That it may be to do with culture, it may be to do with gaps in education, it may be to do with how ridiculous sex education still is, I would say, across the world, almost exclusively. And yet there's something to be said for owning those gaps in your knowledge and seeking it instead, because that's how we can internalize the shame. That's how other people's shame can become our own if we allow it to go unchecked. If we feel bad for not understanding our bodies or our sexuality or so many areas that can be taboo to explore, we're taking on other people's shame versus seeking out the knowledge to understand who we are, to find our power. And yeah, speaking from my own experience, it's been one of the greatest powers to find in my life, is to understand myself better. And only then can you really authentically connect with other people anyway, whether that is dating, whether that's understanding who you are in a workplace or who you are in a friend group. So we will wrap up on that note. If people want to find your work, your wonderful podcast, where can they go?
So if you go to my website, soulsutras.co.uk, come and say hello. There's an email form, so pop up and say hi. If you look for Masala Podcasts, you can find me on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts. Have a listen. And again, you know, feel free to comment and tell me what you think. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter as Soul Sutras. I'm also on LinkedIn as Sangeeta Pillai. So wherever you want to find me, come find me, say hello, and let's kind of get this conversation going. You know, there's enough of all this, you know, shame and kind of worrying that we're not enough. We are.
Oh, love that. All right, we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bobby.
Thanks for listening.
For the full experience, you can join our subscription on Apple Podcasts to access extended ad-free episodes. Our show is edited and produced by Pete Murta.
The music is Digital Damaged by me, Emma Becko.
We're proud to be an independent production.
And leaving a quick review is another way to support the show.
Speak to you next Friday. Until then, good luck out there.